You're listening to Work in Progress. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, Editor-in-Chief of Working Nation. Work in Progress explores the rapidly changing workplace through conversations with innovators, educators, and decision-makers, people with solutions to today's workforce challenges. The COVID-19 pandemic has struck a staggering blow to the economy. Months into this health crisis, we continue to have an unemployment crisis. Millions of people out of work, facing uncertain futures. Joseph Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize-winning economist and professor at Columbia University. Joe, thank you for joining me today on Work in Progress.
Nice to be here.
You know, I'd like to start by talking about where we were at the beginning of the year. While the headline jobs numbers were good, underemployment and a lack of access to opportunity were already big issues. Maybe they weren't visible to all, but they were definitely being felt by the bigger workforce.
That's right. In fact, I thought in many ways the economy was not in great shape. For the last many years, almost all the gains in our economy have gone to the very top. Incomes at the bottom, even in the middle, have largely stagnated. And actually, for people without a college education, there have been marked declines and, you know, may go up one year or down another year. But basically, things have not looked very good. To me, one measure of the health of a society is looking at the health of the people. If the people aren't healthy, you don't have a healthy workforce. And it's a sign something's not doing well, particularly in a rich society like the United States. And one of the really astounding things in the United States is that life expectancy today is lower than it was when President Trump became the president. And at the same time, health inequalities in the United States are enormous, much larger than in other advanced countries. We are the only country among the advanced countries that doesn't recognize the right to access to healthcare as a basic human right. The Affordable Care Act, sometimes called Obamacare, was an attempt to make sure that everybody had access to healthcare. But then many of the states refused to extend the Medicaid program. And then Trump became the president, and millions wound up losing their health insurance. So things by beginning of this year were worse than they were in 2016 in this very critical area. The second thing is, goes back to what I said before, there are people working full-time in the United States that are not making a livable income. Cutbacks in food stamps, in support, in other kinds of support have meant that many Americans don't have enough money for adequate nutrition.
At the beginning of the year, there was this big underemployment issue already. People working multiple jobs to try to reach that family sustaining income. People who were working part-time only because they couldn't find the full-time jobs. Did the pandemic expose this? Do you think people knew this was there? Or do you think this is like new information for people?
Oh, the data was there. Trump often championed what we call the headline unemployment rate, the fact that the official unemployment rate was relatively low. But what he didn't advertise were the multiple symptoms that the labor market wasn't so good. The fact that the employment ratio, the fraction of Americans of working age that were actually working, was actually low compared to other countries, low compared to the United States at other times. As we've been saying, the compensation they get, too many of them were just not getting a livable wage.
Right now, the people who are the essential workers, these are the people who are the lower income people generally.
That's one of the real ironies of what we're talking about. The people who are essential are among the people who are the lowest paid.
Right. And they're out there putting their lives on the line by continuing to work in public while other people can sit at home and work remotely. So there seems like inequity there that we have to address.
Let me just emphasize that inequity, because it shows up not only in low compensation, but they are getting the disease because they are both more vulnerable. They have, you might call, pre-existing conditions, and they are more exposed. So the inequities are one on top of the other. What do you do? Obviously, we're going to need essential workers. We can't change that, but we can change how much we pay them. The minimum wage in the United States today, adjusted for inflation, is roughly what it was 65 years ago. Can you believe that? No pay raise in more than a half a century, while those at the top have seen their incomes soar. And it's not based on the contribution. Obviously, what we call these workers, essential workers. They're making essential contributions. We're just not paying them adequately. Many of these are people in healthcare sectors, education sectors, frontline workers. And so the first thing we need to do is increase the minimum wage and or provide an earned income tax credit, a way of supplementing their wage so that everybody who's working full time has a livable income.
Is there a business model that you can see that this will keep jobs here in the United States? Because that's always the argument, that they'll go overseas where they can find people who will work for less.
A very large proportion of these jobs are what we call in the non-trading sector. You know, when you get sick, you're not going to fly over, particularly in the middle of the pandemic, to Bangkok to get health care. The worry about jobs moving out is really more on the traded goods, manufacturing goods. And these essential workers we're talking about are in the non-traded sectors, the caring sectors. So the first agenda, raise the wage. Since many of these do receive public support, we're going to have to raise taxes. But again, there's plenty of room to raise taxes. We have a regressive tax system. The people at the very top pay a smaller percentage of their income in taxes than people lower down. We ought to be having environmental taxes that would discourage pollution. We ought to have a whole host of taxes that can actually improve the performance of the economy by discouraging excess speculation, tax on capital gains. There are lots of things we can do to raise revenues that will ensure that our essential workers get a decent pay.
I think you made a point that is very vital that everybody should think about, which is, you know, you're connecting the essential workers. These are the people on the front line to jobs that can't go overseas no matter what. You're going to be going to your neighborhood restaurant and your bar, and these are the people who are serving you, and they also need that wage to help their own families. And I think you would argue that a strong income base for everyone is good for the country overall.
Oh, very much so. One of the reasons that we've had such anemic growth, and our growth has not been really very strong. We had a sugar high for a couple of years from a tax cut for the billionaires and for corporations. But even before the pandemic, that was waning, and forecasts were for 2020 to be actually a growth lower than 2%. And one of the reasons is what drives the economy is people being able to spend. If most Americans, or a very large fraction of Americans, are getting very low incomes, and obviously there won't be that kind of spending that is going to be necessary for sustained growth.
Even before the pandemic, we had been talking about upskilling, bridging that gap between what businesses are looking for in a worker and the skills that people have traditionally had for those jobs or are being trained. What are your thoughts on upskilling? How do you see it fitting into the conversation today?
Upskilling is necessary, but it's not sufficient. By that, I mean, one of the reasons that wages are so low is that we've weakened unions. We have labor legislation that's weakened bargaining powers of workers. We've allowed the corporate giants to exercise monopoly power that allows them to raise prices, which weakens real incomes just as much as lowering the nominal wage that they get. So we have an economic system that works against working people. And so we have to upskill, but we also have to change the rules of the game. 40 years of writing the rules of the game to advantage those at the very top, we now have to reverse that and rewrite the rules to make our economy work for ordinary Americans.
Conversations that I've had with business leaders and people in, you know, management strategy, they've talked about how after the last recession, and probably in recessions and downturns previous, there's a change in the way business is done. For example, now people are saying that people working remotely makes it easier for businesses to do business without brick and mortar establishments. How will that change how we do our work moving forward?
Well, clearly the pandemic has really made us aware that we don't have to do as much traveling as we used to. We can do a lot of things through Zoom. But it's also made us appreciate how valuable real person-to-person interactions are. We miss them. We've learned both. So I don't think we're going to move totally onto Zoom or totally leave our brick-and-mortar kind of stores. But there is undoubtedly going to be a shift. That change may actually make the problems that existed before the pandemic even worse. It will reduce some of the demands of the unskilled labor, and at the same time, help those who have the skills and the kinds of jobs that can be done through Zoom and these kinds of technologies.
And when you look at the economy, what is the biggest weight on it right now?
Oh, the biggest weight on the economy right now is the pandemic. I mean, that's why we're not doing very well. People are not going to restaurants, they're not flying. The first thing we need to do is control the pandemic. But so much damage has been done over the last 6 months that even if tomorrow the pandemic were to stop, we're going to have a hard time resuscitating the economy quickly. You know, there was a lot of discussion of a V-shaped recovery. I always thought that that was a fantasy, but it might have been possible if the pandemic had been brought under control in a few weeks, as many people thought originally. I never did, but a lot of people thought. But now that we're months into the pandemic, balance sheets of companies and households have been eviscerated. Companies have gone into bankruptcies. There has been so much economic damage that we are going to need a lot of government assistance to get the economy to grow again. We need support for the state and local governments. What's been happening in the last few months is our institutions of higher education, our knowledge institutions, our research institutions, again, have been hit like never before. And yet almost no assistance has been given to these. There's a hostility to the very institutions that are the basis of our economic success. It's strange, it's ironic, it's short-sighted. And so these are the kinds of things that I think are weighing on the economy and will continue to weigh on the economy unless we change course. You know, you were talking before about the importance of training. Who does the training? It's really the public sector. And we are weakening the public sector.
Do you feel we're in a recession, or do you think we're in a depression or close? I know we wait for the NBER to declare it afterwards.
Yeah, the recession is usually defined as 2 quarters of negative growth. But the negative growth was so strong in the second quarter of this year that even if the third quarter is positive relative to the second quarter, it's so negative relative to where we were before that anybody would say we are in a deep recession. Whether you say it's a recession or depression, it really will depend to some extent on whether we control the pandemic, how fast that occurs, and what economic policies we adopt. if we continue with the kinds of policies that the Republicans are putting forward, I think there's a good chance we will be in a real depression. If we take the preventive actions that include aid to state and local governments, to our educational institutions, to our healthcare sector, then I think we may be able to navigate our way through this. It's still going to be a recession, but we may avoid the worst.
I guess that's really an academic exercise anyway. It's what how people's lives are really affected by it.
Exactly. And what worries me is that we are not doing what we ought to be doing to protect the most vulnerable. When the downturn began, Congress acted quickly, $3 trillion. Part of that was to say, recognize that the United States, in many of our states, has a totally inadequate unemployment insurance system, and that there would be large numbers of unemployed unless we designed good programs. Other countries did design good programs. We did not. Other countries managed to prevent the unemployment rate from soaring. We did not. But then we offered a supplement to the unemployment insurance program to bring up, you might say, unemployment to a barely livable level. But now that program has ended, and the Republicans refused to renew it. There was an administrative action taken by the president to give a much more cumbersome program, much smaller amounts, puny amounts. But even that little program is coming to an end.
We're where we're at now with millions still unemployed. If we don't take actions, what do you see in our future?
Well, I see a lot of suffering. One of the things we know is that that suffering has long-term consequences. The children in the families are going to suffer. And when they suffer, that means our productivity in coming years will be lower than it otherwise would have been. So there's going to be a lot of suffering. But from the macroeconomic point of view, the ability of the economy to return to where it was at the end of 2019 is going to become more and more difficult. It'll be longer and longer and longer before we get back to December of 2019.
As you know, well know, economics is often called the dismal science because maybe conversations like this, you know, because they're eye-opening and important, but they're also a little, you know, scary. Do you have optimism anywhere that we will get back on the right path?
Well, I do have some optimism. I see it in my students, the young people across the country that have marched, who have expressed their support for economic justice, social justice, environmental justice, racial justice, to encourage us to get on to another course. And you know, you see polls on policy, what I would call the progressive agenda that I've described, you know, get support from 60 to 80% of Americans. So if you talk about the concrete policies, healthcare for all, access to university education for everybody who's qualified without getting into an enormous amount of debt, a minimum wage that is significantly higher than today's minimum wage, livable incomes, better financial regulation, more effective competition policy, especially as it pertains to the digital giants, and more better privacy. You name the issue, and the vast majority of Americans really are on the progressive side. They don't like the fires that are burning in California. They don't like the hurricanes. They don't like the floods, and they understand the connection between this and climate change. To me, this is my source of hope, that you might say we've won the generational battle. These are the people who are the future of the United States. If we can only make sure that their voice is heard, the future of America reflects our young people, then I think that we will be able to address these issues.
On that note, Joe, I want to thank you for joining our podcast.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I've been speaking to Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist and professor at Columbia University. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, editor-in-chief for Working Nation. Thank you for joining me.